Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So, with some conversation back and forth with one of your noble leaders, Abigail, I'm kind of focusing on the purity culture thing, which, if you don't know what I mean by that, I didn't know really what that meant until a few days ago, did some research, but I'm going to talk mostly in a general way about theology of the body, what John Paul II is doing there, what I see at the center of it, which actually has a lot to do with purity, because at the center of this work that is so well known and I think much less actually read, a lot of the central beauty of it, the theological wisdom is meant, and it has to do a lot with the power of God that is manifest through the resurrection. But just, I'm going to begin, this is all Abigail's fault again, where I'm beginning, with looking at the purity culture. As I read more and found some actual scholarly articles, it became familiar to me. I'm an adult convert, and I had some really serious evangelical friends, big families up in Canada, wonderful, wonderful people. And I saw some signs of this. And these are just, this is not scholarly research, these opening things before I actually get into theology of the body, but some elements of this might sound familiar to you, some out of date. So under sort of either purity culture, extreme purity culture, usually the chronology begins with, like in the 80s, the Reagan administration starts to allocate funds to abstinence-only sex ed in schools. Okay, that increased under President Clinton and then Bush the Elder. In the 1990s, some of you have mentioned, and I know it's not just big in Virginia, it's more prominent in the South, organizations like Focus on the Family, you see a cultural phenomenon arising, and my kids did this too, like father-daughter dances. Adorable, love it. But I had a lot of friends too who had these kind of things that had almost liturgical moment quality for them. I dated a guy, family with 10 kids, son, daughter. The daughter had this special moment. I think she was 15. She went with her dad, and he gave her a ring, and this was a symbol of how she was entrusting, in a way, or promising to keep her virginity to her dad. You break this, you're breaking your dad's heart, basically. But a sort of outward sign of a promise to be chaste in one form or another. As an aside, I would mention nothing like that necessarily with the sons. But you see this language in one famous publication and in some ideas for doing this within the family, language like guarding the heart or do this or don't do that. Hey, good timing, we just got started. Language of, you know, protect yourself, keep pure so that you do not, quote, betray your future husband, unquote. And to be honest, I thought the vow, like, it's not a vow, it's a promise. That's a different thing, is a little bit odd. The dad-daughter thing is an interesting dynamic. There's a third point here that some social scientists, and you got to read this with a grain of salt, depending on their perspective, that sometimes they critiqued here an objectification of women being reaffirmed by a strong message that it's their responsibility to protect the virtue of all. But on the other hand, that they're responsible for their sins, even giving the occasion of temptation to others. There's some research showing that this can play out in strange ways when it's practiced really strongly after marriage, like with feelings of shame and so on and so forth. Most scholars inevitably reduce this to a phenomenon of Protestant fundamentalism. The fundamentalism word is a tricky one for me. Like, this fundamentalism is a modern phenomenon. It's a reaction to certain modern currents that all Christians, all people should find genuinely troubling manifestations of modernity that include rationalism, scientism, but also currents in religious life, like biblical criticism, how we interpret the Bible, and changing cultural mores, of course. But this is how cultural change works. And in the Catholic Church, we see this too. I'm not even going to get into the example of liturgy, right? Stuff goes a certain way. There's a reaction. Usually, over time, taking the long view is a good thing. But this is how reaction to things that are genuinely problematic work. A downside of this is when people react in a mode of like crisis, this can lead to a reaction that can generate a posture of a kind of moral thinness, maybe a rigidity, a sense of inability to just receive people as they are, work with moral gray areas in a way that's positive. This could tie into some research gets into modesty norms or inconsistency and how that's played out in obedience. But overall, this negative view of the body, and I think this is kind of what Abigail was getting at, who has no issues with the goodness of the body. She's eating her kebab right now. Done with references to Abigail. Absolutely. but I think your use of the word Gnosticism, or what Augustine would have called Manichaeism, sort of getting back to John Paul II, it's interesting to see when popes sort of grab onto one particular problem or heresy in the modern age that seems to define what they're teaching against. For Pope Benedict XVI, the defining heresy of modernity was Pelagianism. I can save myself. I got it together. Thank you very much. So his major encyclicals are on the theological virtues. No, grace goes first. Get over yourself. That's the Augustinian moment. For John Paul II, the great heresy of modernity is Manichaeism. It's that dualism. And it is, as you mentioned, like it can lead to different forms of hatred of the material or disparaging the material. And for John Paul II, what he's diagnosing in modernity, and this is absolutely right on, is a kind of dualism. And we are dual, soul, body, but a dualism that is like vicious or reductive. That is, I am fundamentally, my identity is my soul. That is the foundation of my personhood. Yes, I have a body. When I die, whatever. But this is my personhood. And he's critiquing a way of looking at our bodily life as my body is other. And you're probably familiar with language like instrumentalizing, like my body is a means to an end. Like my work here at this university, my task is to be a good student and to be a good friend and to figure out my future. The bodily stuff is flag football or getting up at 6 a.m. or whatever. Like it's the body is an instrument, a means to an end. And he's really going at this big anthropological picture, not just its manifestation with regard to certain views about sexuality that are unhealthy. So I'm going to get back to, I mean, the purity thing, the danger that I'm suggesting, and people sometimes critique John Paul II for strongly contributing to a trend or a shift in Catholic thinking, as in the 1950s, 60s, you see Catholics like in the United States and Europe, they're losing their sense of rootedness. Like, I am a Boston Irish Catholic. I go to school here. This is my parish. Like, there's like a seamless web of their cultural experience. As that Western cultural rootlessness is just increasing, some people argue that it's being replaced with something else because we need a culture, we need a land, we need a family, we need a people, we need a language. It's being replaced with a kind of new culture, which is this sort of pro-life moralistic culture. I don't think that that's quite right. I think that that can be a way of interpreting what is going on there. But he is strongly addressing, and he's just right here, that the problems that hit young people, old people today, this critique began back in the 1920s, 30s. It started von Hildebrand realizing, oh, snap, like we have no theology of married life. Like there's just nothing written about marriage since Augustine, pretty much. Like we have no reflection, and all the stuff that's coming in the post-industrial age is going to fall on young people and on families the hardest. And John Paul II is just right there. All right, so theology of the body, if you want to buy a book after this, there's a great project of re-editing and retranslating the works of John Paul II, which is really fantastic, especially Acting Person. This edition is still available with a fantastic introduction by the brilliant Michael Waldstein at the beginning. He collects and edits these. What we usually refer to as theology of the body, he refers to as man and woman, he created them. Some of you know these are collected Wednesday papal audiences. We know that he drafted a lot of these writings long before he was elevated to the papal throne. This raised a question from people who didn't like theology of the body stuff. First of all, what is the degree of authority of Wednesday addresses? Like, he wrote this stuff before he was made pope. These are good questions, but if they're even questions at all in your mind that I'm raising, I don't think we need to worry about them because papal genres are always developing. Like you look back to the papacy of Pope Leo XIII at the end of the 19th century, the church speaks through encyclicals because the pope is no longer a major world leader anymore. Pope Leo has to proclaim, he has to exhort, he has to write these letters that are really for the whole world. The church is finding its missionary teaching voice. Wednesday addresses are relatively new, so I think we're just figuring that out. But he did write a lot of it before, and it does speak to his very unique, lots of self-education, but also a very unique kind of Polish philosophical formation that he had. Words often mean just what he means, that he think what he says they mean. Also, John Paul II, he is subject to significant development in his thinking, and you see this in his published writings. He's just really working through stuff, and through his papacy, when he has Cardinal Ratzinger at his side, I imagine them having theological chats over breakfast every day. But the way he uses language is very, very distinctive. So I really do encourage you to take some time and look at I'll go through the structure of the text, but read parts of the text. It's weird. Like, he says, my method's phenomenological. And he means what he means by phenomenological. Nuptial, spousal, people use these words like everyone knows what they mean, and no one does. Okay, they mean what John Paul II does, but you gotta spend some time with the text and find some anchors to plug these words onto. That ambiguity of language can be a problem. So as I said at the beginning, I think people talk about him much more than read him. He has some very famous popularizers, and that's a really helpful thing to have. Sometimes they focus on what they want to focus on. Moreover, I've seen more high school curricula based on theology of the body than anything else. I think that's like on the East Coast, like further north of here, that's with the Dominican sisters. I think they're still using a curriculum based on this. And it's pretty good. It's basically based on the first third, maybe a little more than a third of this. But it's a language that is open to being interpreted in many different ways. So you have moral theologians doing some weird stuff with his language of complementarity and stuff like that. But just keep that in mind when you pick him up and start reading him. And as a last note about the challenge of reading him, do appreciate, like, think of Pope Francis, for example, Amoris Laetitia, which most people didn't read beyond two footnotes that were talked about in the press. He is very, very close to John Paul II. He's staying very close to him. You'll see his language about maturity and courage deeply resonate with John Paul II. But Theology of the Body, as I see it, offers a grand, sweeping Christian vision of creation, the nature of the human person, and the centrality of the cross in the life of holiness. And then at the end, you have actually a relatively brief treatment of married love, and then like 90 pages on Humanae Vitae. The church is teaching about the value and end of human sexuality. He emphasizes how realistic and pastoral as it is, because he knows full well that people look at Catholics, Catholic Church, no contraception. Hold off, people, with this and that. Are you kidding me? It just seems crazy. And he keeps coming back to this. No, this is not just for your good, not just a bunch of guys in black shirts telling you what to do with your body. This is for your joy, your happiness, and it's really possible. Like, this is his central point here. But I make the point about, like, when you sort of break down, like, the bits of this, most of this book is, there's the stuff I'm going to go over really briefly about Genesis, original innocence, original solitude. The heart of it is the cross. My point just being, if people are actually trying to live what Jesus asks of them, the stuff at the end is just details. Okay? This is my broad sort of general thesis about moral purity or moralism, or why one should not think of John Paul II as like teaching a certain kind of morality, like just don't do these three things and you're definitely getting into heaven, or you're going to have a great life. Like, no. Jesus goes right to the heart and condemns the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, and he condemns all of us. Purity is something that we're all called to, but it's much more profound, interior, and beautiful, and the particular decisions that flow from that in your life come from that wellspring of grace of Christ in the heart. So he is not, structurally speaking, in terms of the text, a moralist. Okay, so you have a handout with just a couple things on there, just paper to doodle on if you need some paper, do some art. So as I've just said, John Paul II sees himself as working to overcome key modern tensions. I mentioned the unhealthy dualism as he sees it between soul and body, but also at the same time between individual and community. Okay, so it's a second and related dualism. That's why he begins in Genesis, and that ease with which man and woman held or possessed themselves as both body and soul. Okay, so having, and he'll use the word integration a lot, got to think about that, just being like, I am at one with myself, soul and body. Everything's awesome, loosely speaking. And what the nakedness then represents is precisely that ease. And as when you read Genesis on the effects of the fall, like we talk about sin, like immaculate, macula. Macula means a stain. I think a lot of people think there's that moral dirtiness. I've put a mark on my soul. But the effects of the fall are disruption. First of all, like I lose my interior self-mastery, right? This is not just sexual shame. This is, I don't know what, like it's Adam hiding from God, which is a stupid thing to do. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not at home with myself. Covenant between Adam and Eve is broken. Covenant between humans and God is broken. And covenant between humans and nature is broken. Now the earth will stand. They worked before the fall. But now, as Augustine points out, there'll be thorn and thistles. Everything's going to feel against you. So sin needs to be understood fundamentally as this vicious dualism, this breaking of covenant. So for Adam and Eve, though, they possess themselves, or they're comfortable, that's not a great word, at ease with themselves, and as also with creation and with God. And the mark of this is that there's no self-seeking of any kind, but rather an appreciation and delight of nature, of other, of God, without any objectification or self-seeking. So if you look at that handout there, the text of Theology of the Body, as it's been organized, these addresses, falls into two parts. And I'm just going to talk very briefly about A and B, a bit more about C, and almost nothing about part two, a little bit at the start. But it's, yeah, the first part there is, he refers to as the triptych. You know, it's like a three-piece altar. You'll see in a lot of altars in Europe and sometimes in the United States. On the beginning, the human heart and the distortion of the human heart, and then the resurrection. And what I was suggesting at the beginning is part one, C, is really the heart and the key center of Theology of the Body. Okay, so I'm just going to say a bit about part one here. Okay, is Eden ideal? Is it where we all want to go, end up? And I say ideal because you start reading, you read 100 pages in, and he talks about how great it was and this and that. Like, that's great, but that I don't know what that's like. And he admits finally, whatever it was like to be without sin, we're never going to plug into that experientially. And that's what he means by phenomenological. He is a pope who is coming from a profound place of pastoral experience. He spends a lot of time with young people, married people, and he talks to them all the time. So phenomenological means based on experience for him. And he admits, yeah, based on experience, we're not going to have any real insight into what it was like to be without sin. Okay, but hold on, we'll get there. So Eden is not an ideal of like moral purity. Someday I'll get married. I have to have sex like Adam and Eve would have sex. Read Augustine's City of God, book 14. Doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, doesn't matter. We can't access it imaginatively except through the lens of the cross in a certain sense. So he's not proposing any kind of perfectionism with regard to society or marriage. However, he adds that the cross, this is the thing, is not a return to Eden, but the cross opens a way to a higher perfection where we acknowledge that we're sinners. We'll always be sinners. In all of our relationships, we're still going to be wearing the clothing of shame, as it were. Like, shame at a natural level has a very positive function. Clothing is both expressive and it's also protective. So in a way, that's, I wouldn't say clothing's about shame, but the way that we express ourselves and also receive others has a very natural and very good dimension. But in terms of the scriptural text, he's saying, again, this is not simply, and John Paul II is clear about this, it's not sexual shame. That clothing that is put on, that hiding from God, is meant to sort of symbolize or teach us about the fact that we no longer trust God with sin. That's the lack of trust is the thing that is the mark of the break with God. Then John Paul II really works hard with Genesis 2. Some of you might be familiar with, you know, some people say there's two creations account, Genesis 1, Genesis 2. He works with the distinction that's widely accepted between priestly and Eloist authorship, says Genesis 2 is more ancient. Whatever the case may be, the second creation account, Adam's, the dirt, it's more earthy, more experiential. Adam has to look at dogs, snakes. If he's in Florida, alligators, like, is this my best friend? Is this? No. It's more like human, and it's less liturgical and metaphysical in its character. And he says, he talks about original innocence. And he says we have to plunge our imagined roots into that text. Plunge. He says, again, as I said just now, the nakednesses do not reduce us to merely an absence of sexual shame. Rather, it's that ease of being oneself and receiving. This is a key idea from the other as a gift. To receive another person as just a gift. I don't want anything from you. All I want is your good, not to my detriment, but I receive you, like, it's just wonder. It is so good that you are. Like, that for John Paul II is the mark of love that is striving towards what we see in the love of the Trinitarian persons. Okay, second point, Adam is created in this original solitude. This might be a little bit distinct of JP2. We're talking about Pope St. John Paul II. No disrespect meant. JP2 is fewer syllables for our purposes. Many earlier theologians, like church fathers, consider Adam and Eve as really kind of one person, and they manifest different sides of the human person. And John Paul II acknowledges this, but he says, you know, as a matter of sort of, you know, history, that they are distinct and integral persons. And this solitude is really interesting because on the one hand, it suggests that Adam knows that he's missing something. There is a sense of Kantian autonomy there. That is, like, Adam is sort of freely seeking his other, his friend. And that freedom is sort of the basis for human dignity for Kant. But I think it's more important, that sense of potency dynamism. That is, the second point, not just that we are one being, but that we're created for the other. Again, I am my own integral person. I'm just fine without all, I'm not fine with you guys, without you guys, but like I am a complete member of the human species. That's clear. But there's so much evidence that just confirms this, that like children who are put in orphanages with hundreds of kids and have very little human interaction have all sorts of developmental problems. And I mean, you see this from how a baby is born. Little baby can focus exactly the distance between the crook of the arm and like where the breast is, basically, in the mother's face. We need each other just to become ourselves. So that potency, that dynamism, is a really important second dimension of this original solitude. This is where the word, this nuptial or spousal, comes from. Doesn't necessarily mean getting married. Doesn't necessarily mean anything very sexy. It means that something about our human nature, we have our nature, kind of Aristotle's first actuality, but that our fulfillment, our perfection, our second actuality essentially necessarily requires the other. In a way, it's very close to Aristotle's observation that there cannot be human flourishing without friendship. Man is by nature a political animal, or the biblical idea that we are made for covenant and that that's what God is working tirelessly to restore in the Old Testament. So you could think relational instead of spousal or nuptial. And then the sort of the third point is the effect of sin and the interest in shame. If you take a look at this part of Michael Waldstein's introduction, it's fascinating. John Paul II wrote his second dissertation on Shaler, Max Shaler, who is a strong critic of Kant. And he's critiquing Kantian rationalism. And Max Shaler has a fascinating work on shame. You can find it as a PDF online. But shame, he says, is, yes, it has a natural level, but a supernatural level, but it's basically a result of sin, a broken covenant. Under shame, I do not look upon you, all the other, as a gift, but rather, instead of wonder, appreciation, care, what do you guys do for me? What can I get out of you? What am I getting out of the Thomistic Institute? Like, how is there a benefit for me? Does this help me attain my goals? Does it give me joy, pleasure? But I want to emphasize here, and John Paul II is very clear, shame is, again, not just simply sexual shame. It's that sense of, I can't trust anymore. Like, what's going on in the other person? What are they thinking? At the most basic level, John Paul II says this is a sense loss of self-possession, unity of heart and mind. So the goal in the life of holiness and what Adam and Eve possess is, again, that total integration. You can think of this in another way, because he'll get to Matthew, the preaching of the Sermon on the Mount. You know, our Lord goes after hypocrisy more than anything else. More often than not, he says, do not be afraid, because fear is the opposite of faith, trust. Just trust me. But when he's pointing the finger and he's angry, it's hypocrisy. And I think of hypocrisy as precisely the opposite of what he means by integration. Like, am I as consistent on the inside as I am on the outside? Is my outside manifesting the inside? And that's a big ask. But that hypocrisy, that disjunction, is what he is saying is the anthropological effect of shame. And there's a quotation I'm going to read to you there about shame. The man of shame or of sin finds his root in doubt, lack of trust in the gift of the other, of God. I heard your step. I was afraid. I saw. I was naked. I hid. Self-mastery is lost, and thus the possibility of giving and receiving with totality is impossible. The body, the very self, takes on the character of tension or hostility, and even the possibility of progress of self-mastery is experienced as a kind of harsh domination. In the relationship between persons, reception with integrity of the other as a gift becomes instead possession with domination. And that's how he understands the passage from Genesis 1 to after the fall. Like, man and woman are both tasked with dominion, from the root for lord, lordship, care, stewardship, versus domination, crushing, sensing the opposition. This is true for any relationship, but in very precise ways in the complementary relationship between man and woman. Okay, so the second part of part one, I'm going to speeding up a little bit here. Just a little bit, sets up for the resurrection by discussing the effects of sin, not only shame, but John Paul II uses Matthew 5:8, the Sermon on the Mount, and in particular the teaching on adultery, 5:28. I say to you that if you look at any other person with some kind of covetousness, possessiveness in your heart, you've committed adultery. One of the things that John Paul II says in his addresses that really ticked off some people is he said that concupiscence, that gaze of concupiscence, adultery in the heart, he said that can even happen within marriage. Like, in a sense, when a spouse looks at the other, like, what do I get out of this person? That is a failure of the call to, again, we're not sure yet how we're getting to this, realizing this high standard, but yeah, people can use each other even within marriage. This ties into some of the stuff you see coming out of the research on the purity culture, is that people get this message, and Catholics get it too. Get to the altar, don't do anything wrong, good formation, just go, just do whatever you want. Moral free, neutral zone, that kind of thing. It's like, no. Part of what is so beautiful with what John Paul II is doing when he actually does get to marriage, and I see this in my students, is when he speaks, I'll get to this, when he speaks against St. Paul and certain readings of St. Paul, I think that people want all states of life, including marriage, to be a noble and courageous call to a life of holiness. It's not just for the people who aren't willing to go to seminary for 7 years or 14 years if you're a Jesuit or something like that. Okay, like the universal call to holiness is one of the key implications of the centrality of the cross here. So he talks in this second part of part one about concupiscence, the look of concupiscence, a little bit more about shame, that loss of freedom of the gift, and how Manichaeism doesn't propose any solutions. And then he gets to purity, which is what we're mostly talking about today, and purity in connection with wisdom. But that loss of freedom of the gift, like when you hear words like self, I'm going to talk just really briefly about his work on Shaler here. I hear words like mastery and possession, and it does sound like, I'm in control, man. Okay, he would say, no, it's about freedom. Like, you can't give something you don't have. We all know this in our lives. Like, I got these areas in my life where I don't feel that I am in control. Like, I feel like these things have too high a value for me. That language of self-mastery, self-possession is all about purity of heart, because as he's going to explain purity of heart, blessed are the pure of heart, they shall see God. It's not about, no, no, don't do that. No, no, you're not doing it right. It's about God and that the intensity of love where everything else kind of fits into place around it. So John Paul will say over and over again, whether we talk about chastity, conscience, states of life, it's always an affirmation. So just really briefly before getting into the, you know, sort of towards the end, the how he handles states of life and purity, a few words here about how he gets here with his second dissertation. So he's reading, we don't always know what he's reading. He has these philosophical lectures. Acting person, you can see him doing his phenomenological thing, also getting a little bit closer to St. Thomas in some regards, but he writes his second dissertation. His first is on St. John of the Cross. He writes this super snappy in Rome. He only spends 3 semesters there with Galigou Lagrange. If you're Dominican, doing the Dominican education, you're not out of there in fewer than 4 years. But he does a dissertation, then later goes back, and he's reading this guy, Max Shaler. So for him, what Kant represents is nature, basically, like, dominion. Yeah, I know what that looks like. the function of human reason is to bring order to chaos, basically. I receive nature, all the things that are not subject to the laws of science, that are not predictable, sensations, feelings, basically the sum of natural experience, experiences. It says, according to Kant, order comes from systemic and rational self-control. There's that word. Nature must be reduced from chaos to either art or organized products. And you can see how the critique of technological, you know, functionalizing could play into this. Shaler, by contrast, and hence his interest, does not like Kant, thinks that he's proposing a rationalist sort of form of law just being imposed artificially. Shaler critiques Kant emphasizing love as an act of the will as the only truly authentic human experience. The term phenomenology for Shaler describes an attitude to the natural world marked by acceptance, love, and devotion. Shaler could have gone further, noting that for Kant, I mean, with his critique, that is, like, the problem with saying Kant is all about reason, Shaler's all about feeling and love and mushy things, is that for Kant, like, law is the arbiter of what is, well, reasonable and good, but law is fundamentally subjective. It proceeds from me and it is imposed on others and the world around me on the basis of the authority of my autonomy. Shaler doesn't go that far. So, but you see him saying anything, anytime you use the word objective or essence, he's like, cut it off right now. Where JP2 breaks with Shaler is that he goes so far, he likes the dominance of love, of will, but it, more than that, the acceptance of nature, the valuing of creation. But he's worried about him ending up with feeling as describing this pre-rational tending to things as they are. So Shaler ends up saying, along with many modern thinkers, Rousseau is in a way the most difficult, challenging version of this. Like for Shaler, along with the rationalists, the human person, you don't have an essence in nature, right? Like I'm not an object, I can't be an object of thought, I'm irreducible. What I am, my nature, is basically the unity of my conscious experiences. So I am my actions. Sounds a little bit like being defined by your actions, but it's different. He just wants to avoid anything that sounds like objectivism or reductionism. And this is where JP2 says, this is too far. I can't go this far. And making feeling, even in a rich sense, a basis for an ethics is going to be impossible. Norms, like just a sense of like, what would make me happy? What are some things I could do to deal with this problem in my life? Those are not just arbitrarily coming from your mind to be imposed on me. At least they shouldn't. They should be based on like understanding of the human person and what human flourishing is. If Aristotle can do it, you guys can do it. So Shaler's approach does not address this common modern philosophical problem. Okay, that's evacuating human persons of some kind of nature essential characteristics. By the time you get to Rousseau, the nature of the human person is liberty. This is his argument from the one hand, the absolute right to revolution, and you take that and you either go to Lockean Americanism or communism. Like basically, just you can overthrow anything because there is no like obligation, properly speaking. But second of all, he sees the problem, JP2 and Shaler, of the opposition between reason and will, love. Pick one. I am a man of reason or I am a man of feeling and love. And third, the opposition between the self and the world is really problematic. They're both basically subjective in their approach. And then John Paul II asked this, his most important critique, if we're looking for a Christian ethics, it's going to have Jesus somewhere in the middle. No question. It's going to be fundamentally about Christ because it's about grace. God's got to fix the problems in my life fundamentally. And only then can John Paul come back again and again to this point. This is realistic because God is God. You're not God. God can actually do this. So getting back to the text, then John Paul II really emphasizes on the one hand, Jesus Christ as an example, not just lawgiver. You see this in the Franciscan trope about actions and words, more actions rather than words, but also appealing to the sense that all of us have as free persons and we're actually responsible for our choices. But the third thing that brings him back to Shaler in Theology of the Body is critiquing and correcting Shaler's understanding of happiness. Being unhappy is not just feeling bad. We all have bad days. I've had bad moments today, usually outside in the unbelievable humidity of this part of the world. But that's not happiness or unhappiness, so to speak. our fulfillment is just the things that give us true fulfillment can be discerned, but we also know deep down inside that perfect happiness is not like a naturally possible thing. So happiness, blessedness is going to be fundamentally not the sum of good feelings, but it's going to be, as he says, theomorphic. It's only going to be fulfilled and being transformed more and more into the divine, who is our principle and our end. It's going to be relational. It's going to have to do with other people. So it's going to be basically communal, ecclesial. Even if we don't like people all that much, it's going to have to do with the church. So in summary, just again, totally I'm with Shaler here, JB2 takes from Shaler positively our relational dimension, our fulfillment in the other. And he sees the need for balance between this personal experience language, but also this is the point where he sees objective norms that are really human norms, not just arbitrary things. These are profoundly anthropological, and yeah, we need them. We need them. If there wasn't a sign out there saying 45 miles an hour, I need that sign. Otherwise, I'm just going to land to my rental Toyota Sienna, because why not? It's a rental car. We need the law, and we need laws that are good for all of us, that protect other people and myself. Okay, so getting to the end here of kind of getting to the start of part two then, in a way, the key thing is the proclamation of sin. He does not avoid this problem. And again, this is why the section when he starts to talk about married love, and you might have heard some talks about this or summaries in theology where he's talking about Tobit, you know, he gets down his knees and prays before on his wedding night. He's like, please, Lord, you know, make sure I don't sin. That's all you read. Realism about sin is a really crucial and underappreciated part of theology of the body. Again, I know that I am overstating the matter here, but I have heard people say, well, very positively, like I've heard parents say that, you know, some of this text gives them a way to talk to their children that's more than just don't do stuff. That's great. But I've also heard a lot of people say this is about how, you know, Catholic sex is the best sex of all. I don't know how you could read one page of this text and get to that, because the whole point of his treatment, even of Tobit, is we're going to mess up sometimes, and we're going to mess up sometimes within the context of the marriage covenant. So a lively sense of sin is precisely that moment where we sort of put down our Kantian mastery moment and say, I need help. Like, I am open to grace. And this is why I say to you guys that really, I think the center and the beauty of this text that is missed is that, like, part 1C, and he says it over and over again. It goes back to Matthew 5 and the follow-up exchange about the resurrection of the dead. Whose husband is she going to be? It's like, he's like, no, you do not understand the resurrection. And you say, if God can raise the dead, like, this is the primary thing shown about God in the resurrection. Death can have no hold over God. If God can raise the dead, he can make me holy, even just a little bit. Or just like, so it's a challenge to faith. Like, does faith and trust in God's grace actually result in something? And to my mind, this is the great, like, pastoral proclamation at the center of this text. It's Christ and Christ who has the power of raising up the dead at the center of all this. So no, theology of the body is not about going back to original innocence, overcoming original shame, sin-free sexual acts, anything like that. It's about a deeper submission to grace. But coming back to bad ways of thinking about purity, that deeper submission is not a hatred. It's rather like of my bodiliness or of my desires. It's rather seeking that greater integration of myself and being honest about where I need to grow up. And he says very specific, it's not a Gnostic hatred of being in body. Rather, and this is our origin moment, I don't know if you guys know about origin, he says, what we see in the resurrection, you read 1 Corinthians 15, right? We're sown a natural body, raised a spiritual body, whatever that means. He says, you listen to the liturgy of baptism. He uses terms that are very traditional, like divinization, theosis, the spiritualization of the body. And he doesn't mean that we're becoming like, if you're old like me, you know, like what the Star Trek thing looked like, you know, when you go onto the planet, the material stuff, like the atoms just, I don't really get it. But like, it sounds like right now you should be becoming more like ethereal. It's like, no, it has to do with that deeper integration, like the inner shining more clearly through the outer. And he says, this is fundamentally an eschatological reality, but back to the power of the resurrection. It's starting now. And you got to, like, work at it. But this is where he shifts to like the last part of the text I'm going to talk about, these states of life. He says, this is a high calling, and it's the universal calling to everyone. And by talking about these states of life, I think it helps to illustrate how he's working so hard to show that the church's teaching about degrees of perfection and states of life is still exactly what it's always been. If you take solemn vows, keep to the evangelical councils, poverty, chastity, obedience, you will be objectively more perfect than me. And I'm just fine with that. But he's perfectly clear, as St. Thomas was clear, as St. Augustine was clear. It doesn't mean you're better than I am. The only mark of perfection of holiness is charity. The evangelical councils are supposed to extend to all states of life. You guys are not living radical poverty right now, and you can't. I can't. I have children. St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, the great American saint whose remains are my hometown, like the Daughters of Charity were founded. And she's like, I know Trent said women religious are all going to be behind walls, but our mission is to feed the poor and educate girls. So, sorry. And she had children too. Your state of life determines us, but we're all supposed to have a kind of detachment, like a non-clinginess, as it were, to our material goods. So the states of life, as John Paul II talks about, and I love reading this with seminarians, but also with good old, my awesome students, he describes, and in the Middle Ages, the distinction between religious and lay. So lay people, diocesan priests, whatever. And then religious, like that's the big distinction. He's talking more about celibate and married states of life. You can sometimes apply the older language, but he starts by talking about how very often in the past, people interpreted St. Paul, and I use this King James because it's beautiful, I grew up with it, saying, look, paraphrasing somewhat, if I had things my way, you would all be like me. But if you can't, fine, get married, for it is better to marry than to burn. And John Paul II acknowledges that often that's interpreted, if you're just too much of a moral loser, fine, get married. Or even worse, if you're incontinent, must have sex all the time. That's going to be a disaster, he says. This is not what St. Paul means. And he is speaking against a long tradition that tends in that direction. And you can get it from the text. It's not hard. And he says a more healthy way of looking at this that observes St. Paul's other teachings about marriage is what St. Paul is saying there is that the application of that universal call to holiness for people who are not living poverty and obedience to their abbot, so they don't have to worry about themselves, is harder. And this is where the states of life are absolutely central to one another. He says, the celibate man or woman learns from the married, and great questions here about how about all of us people who are in the middle, because we can no longer pretend there are some great materials online here, but just reflecting on just living single life as a Catholic, not being in the state of like waiting for something else and finding your sanctity there. But that's just an aside. But we're going to work with these two states of life. He says, from the married persons, the celibate learns what motherhood and fatherhood look like. Like they see, and he moves on to the Holy Family as the model, the sort of model for what life in community should look like. On the other hand, the married or the non-clerical or non-celibate person learns from the celibate that this is not all I'm made for. You don't complete me, so to speak. You know what I mean? Like this is not my end. Like I am ordered to a higher end. He says that that the celibate also learns from healthy relationality. I mentioned motherhood, fatherhood, fraternity, but also this very JP2 insight that marriage reveals our need that we're made for communion. But yes, that holiness is an eschatological reality that should shape all of our lives is what we should learn from those who have basically planted their flag in the eschatological soil of heaven through the really powerful and just culturally bizarre sign of celibacy. I'm an adult convert. If you guys are cradle Catholics, like you may not appreciate just the idea of celibacy. Never mind the culturally lame formulation of this. Like, it's unhealthy not to engage in sex. Like, this just freaks people out. It's many people will freely describe it as abnormal. And in a wonderful way, John Paul II, what's actually known as St. Thomas Aquinas, he poses this question about whether celibacy is unnatural, and he gives five really good reasons why it's unnatural. And then he gives five really good arguments why it's not. Why it's supernatural, you know, why it's a great good. And it's his arguments, again, are very ecclesial. Like, this is a great gift for the whole church. So just to summarize what I'm getting at here with the complementary of states of life, for good celibacy, and here he's also working against this a way of looking at celibacy and selling it theologically that's just like, no, 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 no. John Paul II says that complementarity is a condition of good celibacy. So the celibate must affirm like the spousal meaning of the body. The celibate also, he wants celibacy to be a healthy human development of personhood. He says not an asexualizing of the person. Therefore, in the temporal order, he says celibacy is to be understood as a renunciation of a good thing. This is a state of life with great goods and great beauty, and I'm saying no to it for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. No denigration whatsoever. There's the power of its sign. He further critiques, and I just love this, it's so powerful, the way in which we just over-sexualize everything, not just people. And he talks about how we understand drive, spontaneity. There's some great literature, a book by my colleague David McCarthy, I think it's called Sex and Love in the Home. Just, he talks about like movies and his neighbors and how we think about like passion and spontaneity. And it could sound like John Paul II, just calm down a bit, people, and everything will be like, forget the passion, spontaneity, say no. Go be striving within these moments of great beauty and great enjoyment. Always be striving for that sense of the gift, the inestimable value of the other. And it's that valuing of the other as a gift that will be the guide for your own growth in moral maturity. He's not after anything that's like robotic, you know, kind of thing. Nothing like that. And he says, he also says that getting love, desire, sexual desire, right? This should make marriage sort of more plausible as a true way of holiness, but also make voluntary continence more plausible and more beautiful as well. Okay, so I'm going to actually finish with wisdom. Here we are. I have a quotation here in your handout for Redemptor Hominis. I'm not going to read it, but it's the first encyclical. He wrote a ton of encyclicals, all very long, very beautiful. His first encyclical after he ascended to the throne of Peter, kind of correcting what he saw as a problem since after Vatican II, people losing sight of the centrality of Jesus in everything, but especially Gaudium et Spes, this very long document touching on a number of things at the end. But it's interesting, this quotation here. We're all familiar with the phrase about like become who you were meant to be or who you are. But it makes very clear that who I am, who you are, is about Christ. Like only Christ fully reveals me and you to ourselves. The century says it fixes Christ's place in the history of man and mankind, unceasingly contemplating the Holy Christ mystery. The church knows with all the certainty of faith, redemption that took place through the cross has definitively restored dignity to man and given meaning to his life in the world. Okay, so ending with purity and wisdom here, because he comes back to the Matthew 5, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And he really wants to reinforce purity as not just moral thinness, not just don't break daddy's heart, which you shouldn't do anyway, but it's kind of weird, let's face it. Is it about the virtue of temperance, exercise over bodily senses, and yeah, those are good things, and it is about the virtue of temperance, but what John Paul II is doing here with the gospel passage is coming back to purity as something that begins in the heart with that recognition of the gift, the goodness of others, and acting and giving oneself accordingly. The problem with some of these methodologies, and I totally get it, I'm a parent. I should be much more clever than I really am in this regard, but I think it gets the end right, this culture of purity, but the means are wrong. And the means that John Paul II is proposing is not a kind of rationalizing control or a methodology or harnessing shame for the sake of control or guilt, rather exhortation and example, patience and mercy. Let Christ be radical in what he asks of us. And this is where he shifts to purity and wisdom. So March 18th, 1981, the Wednesday address, he cites 1 Corinthians 6. Do you not know your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit? And more often than not, I hear that text and I think, oh gosh, like I think about something about my self-care or something like that. He's like, no. like it's not ritualistic impurity that our Lord cares about. John Paul II says the moral duty of the Christian arises from the promise of the resurrection of the body. Your bodiliness has such value, such beauty. Just think about the gifts of the Holy Spirit. When you're baptized, you receive the theological virtues in their fullness, the gifts, fruits of the Holy Spirit. And he stops on wisdom. What is wisdom? Okay, most screaming babies at their baptism, it's really hard to imagine what that might look like. But these are, of course, seeds that are planted in full that must be cultivated. But his point is that baptism highlights the value and the beauty of the bodiliness, that temple that is purified by the Holy Spirit. And he says purity, piety is a gift of the Holy Spirit. By piety, we mean like honoring God. I'm not God, you're not God, you're God. Very simple definition of piety. It's a gift of the Holy Spirit, and piety, not what you do and don't do. Piety is the driver of purity. That is devotion and reverence for God and then for you, for yourself. Like, just think about that, devotion and reverence. I have a hard time with the language of self-love that's so important in Augustine and other thinkers, but that idea of like reverencing and cherishing and caring for, I find much more compelling in that piety, that sense of reverence. That's where purity springs from. And as to chastity, which is a virtue that we should all strive for, this is our really Thomistic moment. Joseph Pieper, in one of his beautiful books on St. Thomas called The Silence of St. Thomas, he observes that, you know, you read St. Augustine, Confessions, okay, it's all about him. We know it's not really all about him, but he talks about himself a lot. St. Paul, constantly using the first person singular. Even not I, but the Lord. Like, he makes a lot of stuff about him. St. Thomas, I think, uses the first person singular once in his entire corpus. People pick it up and read it, and whether you're excited or bored to death, Joseph Pieper observes that you might think he's more machine than man. Like, he's unfeeling, he's clinical, mathematical, sorry to all the math science majors, whatever. And Pieper says this is a total misunderstanding. Just how to understand him as a man. Because he says nothing is about him. He says, it is chastity. Pieper says, chastity is the root of wisdom, and this is the key to understanding St. Thomas. It is that total, intense, almost competitive, but always respectful devotion to truth. God is truth. This is Thomas's first and last love. Everything else fits around it, and he becomes invisible behind that. And of course, the foundation of that, I think this is very similar to what John Paul II is doing with piety, is that poverty for St. Thomas is the foundation of love. That is detachment. Okay, detachment is the basis of all holiness because, again, St. Thomas is a chaste man because he lives a connection between purity and knowing the truth. So think of it in terms of piety, knowing that you are not God, but reverencing God in yourself, or if you prefer more Pieper, a Thomistic approach, that sense of purity as a kind of total devotion to the truth, which in turn translates into chastity as singleness of love. And you see this in Thomas's serenity in turn. Like, he was writing this stuff in very terrible times. Okay, I just sent a couple of students off to Orvieto when the papal court escaped there for 4 years, and he wrote this, dictated the Summa Gentiles, and writing the Corpus Christi liturgy, in a certain sense, writing it. In very difficult times, politically and even personally, he had this kind of serenity. He was never afraid of mystery. Just quote St. Joseph really quickly here. He feared logic as little as he feared mystery. He who fears the bold light of logic will never penetrate into the region of real mystery. The man who does not use his reason will never get to that boundary beyond which reason really fails. So I'm adding a bit of a Thomistic angle to John Paul II's appreciation of the relationship between purity and wisdom, which in turn both arise from true piety. I was going to say a few more things, but I'm going to stop there because we're at like 55 minutes. I did want to come back to the little bit here at the end about Humanae Vitae, but I think you kind of get my point about, you know, the teachings that people are sort of embarrassed about if they're Catholic, or people think it's just crazy. It's like, go for the big guy, like go for the piety and that purity that is just loving God above all things, and the other stuff kind of works itself out. Difficult, but it does work itself out by God's grace. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.